made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumours that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantina, author and journalist. Fra Hughes, thank you so much. Journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina tawaffahum الملائكة ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين ضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المستضعفين ضعفين من الرجال والنساء والولدان لا يستطيعون حيلة ولا يهتدون سبيلا فأولئك عسى الله أن يعفو عنهم وكان الله عفوا غفورا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the UN General Assembly votes to refer Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories to the International Court of Justice. Japan and South Korea say North Korea has fired several missiles toward the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. Also coming up, a U.S. House committee releases the tax returns of former President Donald Trump, who sought to keep them secret for 6 years. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: the United Nations General Assembly has weighed in on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories, calling for intervention by the International Court of Justice. The UNGA has approved a resolution that asks for the advisory opinion of the World Court on the legal consequences of the issue. The resolution also calls on the Hague-based tribunal to intervene on the regime's settlement activities and annexation of Palestinian lands. The resolution was ratified by 87 votes against 26, with 53 abstentions. The World Court last weighed in on the Palestinian dispute in 2004 when it ruled that an Israeli separation barrier was illegal. Israel rejected that ruling, accusing the court of being politically motivated. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has slammed as delusional the Israeli prime minister's claims against the Islamic Republic. Nasser Kanani says Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to forge an identity for himself and the illegitimate Israeli regime. Kanani says the Israeli regime has for 70 years been suffering from an identity crisis accompanied by genocide, looting, forced displacement, and many other human rights violations. He said these atrocities are the result of the wrong policies of the US, UK, and some European countries in supporting the regime. Kanani stressed that Palestine is indestructible, while the Israeli regime is doomed to decline. Netanyahu was sworn in as Israeli Prime Minister on Thursday in a comeback as the head of a hard right cabinet. In his address to Parliament, he accused Iran of seeking to develop a nuclear bomb, an allegation Tehran has repeatedly denied. Israeli forces, meanwhile, conduct a fresh raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, injuring dozens of Palestinians. The troops used live ammunition, rubber bullets, and tear gas against the Palestinians. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details about the raids.
Well, the Israeli forces have raided Nablus city early on Friday. According to the Israeli military, the main aim of the operation was to arrest a Palestinian who is a member, as you have mentioned, of the Lion's Den group, Ahmed al-Masri. After, few hours of clashes that took place between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces who raided the city of Nablus, unfortunately, at the end of the day, Ahmed al-Masri, 19-year-old Palestinian, was shot and wounded, and he was arrested by the Israeli troops. 35 Palestinians were also wounded during the operation that took place in Nablus early on Friday. After the Friday prayers, Palestinians were taking part in anti-Israeli settlement protests in the village of Osirin, as you have also said. And as usual, this continues to anger the Israeli military and the Israeli settlers, because at the end of the day, the Israelis don't want for the Palestinians to continue taking part in the different forms of resistance, even it's if it was a popular resistance. Clashes took place, and at least a dozen of the Palestinians were wounded during the clashes that took place in Osirin.
Now, media reports say a U.S. military base in northeastern Syria has come under rocket attack. According to the reports, several explosions were heard after the American base in Deir ez-Zor province was targeted by rockets. In response, the U.S. military scrambled fighter jets and flew surveillance drones over the area. There is no word on possible casualties or damage. The targeted military base is located near Syria's Al Umar oil field, which is under the control of American forces. The military facility has come under several rocket attacks over the past months. Syria considers the U.S. military occupation on its soil as a violation of its sovereignty. Yemen's petroleum company says the Saudi-led coalition has seized four fuel ships en route to the country's key port city of Hodeidah. The firm said the ships were seized after being inspected in Djibouti, where all such shipments are checked under a United Nations mechanism. The company called the move piracy, saying Yemen holds the United Nations and the coalition responsible for the consequences. The firm also called for international pressure for the release of the vessels. The coalition frequently confiscates fuel tankers headed for Yemen. This, along with the wider pressure on supplies of food and medicine, has deepened the plight of millions of Yemenis already suffering due to the Saudi-led war on their country. Elsewhere, North Korea has reportedly fired three missiles toward the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean and Japanese militaries say the projectiles were ballistic missiles. The development is a further escalation to the ongoing tensions in the region. North Korea has testified a record blitz of missiles over the past months. The North claims the tests are in response to the United States' growing presence in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Pyongyang says the exercises are provocative and rehearsals for an invasion. Video call: the Chinese and Russian leaders have called for the expansion of relations between the two countries. The U.S., meanwhile, has expressed concern over China's alignment with Russia. Earlier in our News Review program, we discussed the dynamics of relations between the three countries and the global implications. So let's take a quick listen to that.
Now, welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Chinese President Xi Jinping has been speaking with his Russian counterpart via video conference. While exchanging niceties, the two leaders discuss further enhancing their strategic cooperation.
Your Excellency President Putin, my old friend, it is a great pleasure to meet you once again. It has become a good tradition for us to hold a video meeting at the end of a year. Under our joint guidance, the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination for a New Era has become more mature and resilient.
And she also underscored China's willingness to strengthen its ties with Russia. He said the two countries must help each other develop as global partners to bring stability into a world full of turmoil. The Chinese president also expressed his willingness to hold more such discussions. The Russian president also emphasized the importance of Sino-Russian relations.
In the current situation of tense international and regional relations, the significance of Russia-China Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination for a New Era has been further enhanced as an important stabilizer on the international stage.
Vladimir Putin added that Russia is keen to increase military cooperation with China. He also held the two countries' efforts to counter Western influence, pressure, and provocations. The Russian president invited his Chinese counterpart to Moscow on a state visit in spring. Following the call between Putin and Xi, the U.S. warned China of the consequences of providing military aid to Russia for use in the Ukraine war. U.S. State Department said that Beijing claims to be neutral, but its behavior shows it is still investing in close ties with Russia. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina, and William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess so, Mr. Ray McGovern, we'll start with you, sir. As a U.S., we just saw the Saudis the other week sign a comprehensive deal with a long-term, 25 or 35 years with the Chinese. That was kind of a kick in the face for President Joe Biden, the White House, and the U.S. In general. So if you're losing influence in West Asia, the Middle East, you're possibly through the Ukraine war, we've seen some fractures in the European Union and their policy toward that war. We've seen, so if you're losing a little bit of, you know, face in Europe, a lot of face in the Middle East, why would you find this time to be pushing Moscow and Beijing into each other's arms?
That's a terrific question, and that is exactly the question. It's a puzzlement, as Yul Brynner would say. The only thing that I can reason to is that these people advising Biden, let's face it, Biden is not up to making these decisions, really think that they're exceptional, really think that they're indispensable. You know, they come out of these Ivy League schools, and they're the same kind of best and brightest that brought us the Vietnam War, for God's sake, okay? So if they still believe this, I mean, when I give lectures and I talk, well, you know, do you know about indispensable? Oh, yeah, that's what we are, indispensable. I said, well, what's the antonym? What's the opposite word for indispensable? And some say, well, dispensable? I said, yeah, now put that into the international realm. That ipso facto means that all other countries are what? Dispensable? Yeah. Well, you don't win any friends and don't greatly ingratiate yourself with the rest of the world. Suffice it to say that the world is now bipolar. Now, you can argue that it's multipolar, and there's a good argument for that. But I say that the world has now been divided by this Ukraine conflict and by primarily China's reaction to it between the lily-white West, okay, and people of color. I include Russians because they've been blackened so much in U.S. propaganda that they're ipso facto people of color as well. Now, the people of color, not only in China, not only India, not only Indonesia or Russia or Saudi Arabia or Argentina or Iran, they are going to be the leaders of this next century, and people don't understand that. The worry, of course, is that these U.S. exceptional people won't get it into their heads and will start some kind of war in Ukraine that will get NATO involved with Russia, and God knows what will happen after that. So the right question is, why would they possibly drive these two people together? And later I could tell you one reason I believe that Putin is dead right on this, because he explained it. He asked the question himself.
Thank you, sir. Mr. William Jones, I'd like to welcome to the program, sir. Now, Mr. Jones, it's funny, to Mr. McGovern's point, you have leaders in Moscow and Beijing calling each other buddies now. They weren't doing that 15 years ago. They might not have been the number one enemies, but they were far from calling themselves buddies. And when you're Washington, you know that it's your policies that has led to today these two superpowers calling themselves each other buddies. Your initial thoughts on this, please.
Well, China and Russia have had a long and sometimes torturous relationship, but they are very big countries with a very, very long border. And ever since at least the 14th century, there's been a history of collaboration in terms of economic cooperation, cultural exchanges, and the like. This was disrupted, unfortunately, by the Sino-Soviet split. And for many years, of course, they were looking for other alternatives. China was looking for other alternatives. But the basis of that is their relationship, their close geographical relationship, their close cultural ties over many, many years. And this has been consolidated with the emergence of China as a major economic power that has brought that relationship to a much higher level. What you have today, of course, is the fact that both of them have been targeted by the U.S. military-industrial complex, which is somewhat aware of the fact that they are losing their traditional control of the world, which they had at least with the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And they're working persistently and almost frenetically in order to try and reestablish this by, in particular, trying to isolate both Russia and China. But you're looking at a situation in which not only these two countries, but the majority of the world, and that includes most of the developing sector, including the countries of Latin America, are at odds with this notion that the United States should be the determiner or the rule maker for all of the world. And therefore, there is, if not an alliance, there is tremendous sympathy with both Russia and China in their contest with the United States.
Joining us there, Mr. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst from Raleigh, North Carolina, and Mr. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Washington, D.C. Viewers, that brings us to the conclusion of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's tax returns have been released, ending a controversial six-year battle. A Democratic-controlled House committee released thousands of pages of redacted documents, which shed new light on how the former president handled his finances. The returns span from 2015 through 2020, covering Trump's candidacy and his White House tenure. The documents reveal that Trump paid very little federal income taxes and, in some instances, didn't pay taxes at all. The committee also found that the Internal Revenue Service had broken its own rules by not auditing Trump for three of the 4 years he was president. Trump played down the release of his returns, saying very little information had actually been unveiled regarding his tax practices. Trump faces several legal challenges as he mounts a 2024 presidential re-election bid. And that brings an end to the International Bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
The High Court in London has unfairly ruled that a British government policy to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda was lawful. The decision, which is subject to appeal, comes 6 months after the first deportation flight was due to take off on June 14th. It was grounded amid a series of legal challenges, and so no asylum seeker has been deported to Rwanda under the UK scheme. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truthout wrote in this regard, the policy which involves Britain forcibly sending tens of thousands of migrants to Rwanda in an alleged effort to tackle the record number of refugees and asylum seekers arriving in the UK on small boats has been mired by controversy. The UK's plan to deport migrants to Rwanda is lawful, the High Court claimed recently. The policy, which involves Britain forcibly sending tens of thousands of migrants to Rwanda in an alleged effort to tackle the record number of refugees and asylum seekers arriving in the UK on a small boats, has been mired by controversy. People who have suffered horrors of war, torture and human rights abuses should not be faced with immense trauma of deportation to a future where they cannot guarantee their safety. We believe that sending refugees to Rwanda will breach our country's obligations under international treaties, and we continue to believe this policy is unlawful, Care for Calais said after the London court ruling. The ruling comes as a relief for newly appointed Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who has made a high-stakes political promise to tackle the migration problem in Britain. However, the plan has attracted criticism from opposition parties and human rights organizations in the UK and around the world, as well as across the international community, including the UN. UNHCR remains firmly opposed to arrangements that seek to transfer refugees and asylum seekers to third countries in the absence of sufficient safeguards and standards. Such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. The UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Triggs, announced back in April. A report published by Medical Justice condemns the UK government's deportation plan, claiming that Rwanda deportees include victims of torture and human trafficking. It adds that many asylum seekers have had a lack of access to legal representation and advice, and no access to translated documents from the Home Office relating to their imminent removal and deportation to Rwanda. For many, the deal represents a crisis of responsibility rather than a migration crisis. It ignores the UK's international commitments and sets a dangerous precedent for other countries looking to leverage migration for political ends. Denmark is one of the countries considering a similar deal with Rwanda. However, for the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda, the deal adds unnecessary pressure on the small African state. Rwanda is a small country. We're also not economically a rich country like the UK, so we still have many economic challenges, issues of water, distribution, scarcity, issues with electricity, and issues of gas. So we are not anywhere near ready to receive people coming from the UK, Frank Habineza, a politician from the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda, told Memo. In spite of the court's green lightening of the plan, there is currently no airline willing to carry asylum seekers to Rwanda, with the last company pulling out following pressure from activists. Having already spent £120 million on the deportation scheme, the coming year will see the British regime wrangle new ways to make the plan and its effort to reduce migrant numbers a success. With only 2 years before the next general election, a lot is at stake. So far, in spite of the risk of being deported, more asylum seekers have crossed the channel to the UK in 2022 than in previous years. This has brought into question the effectiveness of the plan and whether or not the unlawful policy can really get off the ground.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the growing strategic partnership between Pakistan and China has caused alarm in Washington. And we shall also look into Nepal's general election results and why it's good news for New Delhi.
Pakistan's growing strategic partnership with all-weather ally China is causing jitters in Washington, especially after Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif's visit to Beijing last month. It comes as the United States seeks to cement its ties with India, a critical regional rival of both Beijing and Islamabad. A recent report by a Washington-based think tank says the U.S. is looking to push Pakistan to change its strategic calculus, which is centered on the country's security environment, while calling for a more nuanced U.S. policy on Pakistan.
Chinese President Xi Jinping told Pakistani Premier Shehbaz Sharif during the latter's visit to Beijing last month that China will continue its fundamental policy of opening up and providing new opportunities to Islamabad and other allies through development projects. Sharif became the first world leader to visit China after the 20th Communist Party of China's Congress concluded, demonstrating the ironclad nature of China-Pakistan relations. Their relationship has lately been defined by a high level of strategic coordination and political mutual trust. Pakistan sees its ties with China as a cornerstone of its foreign policy, while Beijing sees its alliance with Islamabad from a strategic perspective. The strengthening of ties between China and Pakistan has understandably fueled concern in Washington. The U.S. Department of Defense report says China relies on Pakistan to project its military and economic might as Islamabad remains a key Beijing ally. The 2022 China Military Power Report, released last week, examined how China seeks to achieve what it called the National Rejuvenation Objective by 2049 with the help of international partners such as Pakistan. According to the report, China ranks Pakistan as its only all-weather strategic partner and Russia as its only comprehensive strategic partner.
The growing unease in Washington is rooted in China's expanding political, economic and strategic ties with Pakistan as well as Russia, especially with the phenomenal success of the ambitious China-Pakistan Economic Corridor project and Russia's interest in joining it. The fact that the International Monetary Fund review for releasing the next tranche of funding to Pakistan remains stalled since September due to the US pressure, forcing Islamabad to turn to a friendly country for external financing, also shows deepening cracks in ties between Islamabad and Washington.
Relations between China and Pakistan took shape following the 1962 Sino-Indian border dispute as India became a common strategic concern for both countries. The move to cede the Shaxgam Valley in the disputed Himalayan region of Kashmir to China in 1963 further cemented ties between them, much to the chagrin of New Delhi. Fast forward to 2013, China-Pakistan ties were redefined when President Xi announced the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure and investment project whose cornerstone was the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. This came amid growing proximity between New Delhi and Washington. While reports point to the Biden administration's attempt to reset ties with Pakistan, especially after former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan accused Washington of toppling his government, the fact that the International Monetary Fund has stalled the release of the next tranche of funding to the South Asian country, apparently under the U.S. pressure, has left Pakistan in dire need of external funding. Pakistan's finance minister Ishaq Dar on December 2nd said the country expects to secure $3 billion in external financing from a foreign country in 2 weeks. In contrast, China agreed to roll over $4 billion worth of sovereign loans to the South Asian country after Prime Minister Sharif's recent visit to Beijing. A friend in need is a friend indeed.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. A Sun Ho. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the Chinese President Xi Jinping said last month that Prime Minister Sharif's visit to Beijing will provide a new impetus to the all-weather strategic partnership between the two sides. So how significant is this?
Well, the so-called China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is very important economically and strategically to both China and Pakistan. For Pakistan, it means reviving the country's economy, bringing about more development for the country and so on. For China, of course, it would mean China will have another access to the Indian Ocean, for example. So this economic corridor, unfortunately, over the last few years, due to the coronavirus pandemic, it was slowed down. And also sometimes there are, shall we say, political and social instabilities in Pakistan. So that also did not help in terms of bringing this China-Pakistan economic corridor forward. So I think with this visit by Prime Minister Sharif, both the China side and the Pakistan side, they will very much like to revive this China-Pakistan economic corridor.
Sir, why is Pakistan's growing political, economic and strategic partnership with China causing jitters in Washington?
Well, China and Pakistan's traditional friendship went back a long way. I could remember it went back for at least half a century to the late 1960s and 1970s. Actually, it's very ironic. The U.S.-China resumption of their formal relationship was helped by Pakistan in the early 1970s, when Pakistan was sort of the middle person between China and the U.S. in bringing the two superpowers together. But since then, of course, relationship between Pakistan and U.S., sometimes they are very good, sometimes it's not so good, because sometimes the U.S. would accuse Pakistan of harboring some terrorist elements. But sometimes the U.S. Would assist Pakistan militarily. Now, when the U.S. is not in a better relation with Pakistan for a stretch of time. China, of course, sees that opportunity and, well, try to fill in the gap. And, for example, this China-Pakistan economic corridor, because it could potentially benefit Pakistan a lot. So the China-Pakistan relationship sometimes becomes quite warm, as with now. Then, of course, the U.S. is not quite happy about that.
Sir, so do you think the unease in Washington is due to China and Russia emerging as new power centers amid the changing world order and also the success of China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, the problem with recent U.S. Foreign policy, it's sometimes it is very heavy on the rhetoric, but not so heavy on the action part. For example, China, with its Belt and Road Initiative, they would, well, roll out a lot of trading relationship, a lot of investments, for example, in countries like Pakistan. The U.S., on the other hand, for example, sometimes they will condemn some activities by Pakistan. Sometimes they promise certain aids to Pakistan, but very often these sort of aids are not actually delivered. So, you know, from Pakistani point of view, and indeed from the point of view of many developing countries, well, the U.S. Doesn't seem to so-called walk its talk. Whereas China, typically, they were bringing a lot of investments to these countries. Thereby, I think it is almost inevitable that a lot of these developing countries would find themselves more and more friendly with China and perhaps distancing themselves a little bit from the United States.
So, sir, talking about the United States, it has used the International Monetary Fund as a tool to pressure Islamabad into towing its line. So the question is, should Pakistan be looking elsewhere for external financing?
Well, Pakistan's economy is, frankly speaking, not in the best shape. It has to get assistance from whichever source that it could get its hands on. That would include anything from IMF to hopefully a very generous China. And I think that's part of the reason why Prime Minister Sharif is going to China. He was looking for some delays in paying some of the debts owed to China, or hopefully to get some forgiveness of those debts. I think very often you'll find China to be more generous in doing so, especially to developing countries. On the other hand, IMF, well, it has a very rigid, very often Western-oriented standards, and it's very difficult for you not to, you know, pay back to IMF on time and so on. But if your country is simply not in a condition to do that, yeah, then you have to look for sources elsewhere.
Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Government of Pakistan in a tweet said, during his two-day visit to China last month, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed broad-based cooperation in economy and investment and exchanged views on regional and global developments. Researcher and writer Sartaj Khan cites a recent Pentagon report as stating that China ranks Pakistan as its only all-weather strategic partner and Russia as its only comprehensive strategic partner. Chinese embassy in Pakistan in a tweet appreciates Islamabad's efforts in making China-Pakistan relations the cornerstone of its foreign policy, adding that the two sides will strengthen communication and cooperation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Last month, Nepal held elections for the parliament as well as for the provinces, the second vote since the country's constitution was promulgated in 2015. The final result is expected next week, but it appears that no political party will gain the majority in the 275-member house. Odds are in favour of the Nepali Congress-led alliance, which is good news for India. Importantly, the landlocked country situated in the Himalayas has in recent years been the battleground for regional supremacy between New Delhi and Beijing.
The general election in Nepal is being keenly followed by both India and China, the two regional powers. The Himalayan country has, under Prime Minister Sher Bahadur Deoba, shifted more towards New Delhi, sparking concern in Beijing. Thus, from India's perspective, the Deboa-led government is the best possible scenario. The five-party alliance comprises the Nepali Congress led by Deoba, the Communist Party of Nepal Maoist Center, the Communist Party of Nepal Unified Socialist, the Loktantrik Samajwadi Party, and the Rashtriya Janamorcha. Chinese strategists won't be happy with the possible election outcome, considering Beijing's foray into influencing the country's power politics. Over the past decade, the Chinese embassy in Kathmandu played an instrumental role in the merger of Nepal's two frontline communist parties into a single entity, the Nepal Communist Party, which paved the way for the thumping win of the alliance in the 2017 election. China's influence on the communist parties even prompted some to ask whether Beijing was micromanaging the country's power politics. Political pundits say the India-China rivalry to gain leverage in the landlocked country is set to enter a fresh phase when a new government takes charge in Kathmandu. A new turf is ready for the two powers.
The ruling Nepali Congress enjoys deep-rooted ties to India. After Sher Bahadur Deoba succeeded KP Sharma Oli as the country's prime minister in 2021, relations between the two countries not only improved but gained fresh momentum. China and India aren't the only countries with an eye on the Nepal elections. The United States, which has a fierce rivalry with China, is also following the political upheaval. A key strategic ally of New Delhi, Washington seeks to undermine China's Belt and Road Initiative and its Indo-Pacific influence.
After succeeding former Prime Minister Oli, the leader of the Communist Party of Nepal, in what was described as a Game of Thrones in 2021, Deoba embarked on his first visit to India in April 2021. The three-day visit helped resurrect a relationship that had been in the doldrums under the China-backed government in Kathmandu. Even before Oli began his first of the three fleeting terms in October 2015, India and Nepal were at odds over the new constitution that apparently did not include the marginalization concerns of two ethnic groups that live in the region bordering India and constitute 40% of Nepal's population. When Oli was removed from power in his first term, he blamed New Delhi. In 2018, he staged a comeback due to the unification of the communist factions, in which China played a key role. In the second term, India-Nepal relations virtually broke down over the map controversy. With pro-India Deoba in the driver's seat now, the mood in New Delhi is upbeat. The Indo-Pacific policymakers in Washington are also in a celebratory mood, as it will help them further undermine China's Belt and Road Initiative, of which Nepal forms a vital cog.
Now, to talk more on this, we will also be joined by Mr. Goldoni, an analyst and commentator from Hong Kong. But before that, let's continue with Mr. A Sun Ho, who has kindly stayed with us. Now, sir, talking about the Nepal elections, a five-party political alliance led by Prime Minister Sher Bahadur Deoba is set to form the new government in Nepal despite the hung parliament. Is that good news for India?
Well, Nepal is a country which situates itself between India and China. And therefore, when these two big regional powers are not quite friendly with each other, then Nepal, it's very often squeezed in between. And Nepalese politics in recent years have been a contest between China on the one hand and India on the other hand in terms of influencing which parties or which politicians would come to power. Duba is, of course, widely perceived to be more pro-India as opposed to his predecessor, Mr. Oli. And therefore, if Duba were to form the new government, it would, at least for the moment, be seen to be more favorable to India. But of course, because this is, in a sense, a coalition government, and it may not be as stable as if Duba were forming the government only with his party. So I think what we could see now, it's only India has a temporary upper hand at the moment here.
Now, for the next question, I would like to welcome Mr. Goldoni to the program. Mr. Goldoni, the landlocked country has moved towards India since Duba took office in 2021, antagonizing China. But can the new government afford to ignore Beijing amid shifting geopolitical dynamics?
I can say that the coalition that has getting power in 2021 has started to move and shift its attention from China more to India. I believe that in a country where the economic, the GDP is not very high, is quite small actually. We are talking about $45 billion. It's very important to have an economy that is open to the most important driving source of growth in Asia. It means China, definitely. And, of course, also India. So I see this one, reorganizing of a priority, a little bit risky for a country as Nepal. As you said, is landlocked, where they have a huge border with Tibet. So I really think that they should be more careful in rearranging the priorities. Now in this case, I'm talking about economic priorities, and it's quite clear that priority has been most probably imposed by external means, by external actor.
Back to Mr. Ason Oh again. Sir, why is India so important for Nepal and vice versa in terms of strategic and economic interests?
Well, in a sense, India shares more culturally with Nepal. A number of India's major religions originated from Nepal, such as Buddhism and so on. So traditionally, India would consider Nepal to be one of its, in a sense, a protectorate, even though officially they could not call so. But of course, in recent years, as China's economic muscles grow, it also tried to dabble its hands in terms of growing its influence in Nepal. So that's why you have this, in a sense, tug of war between two regional powers, which manifests itself in the politics of Nepal. Sometimes you would see Nepalese leaders who are more pro-China and sometimes more pro-India. But the traditional leanings of Nepal was indeed with India. It's just that, frankly speaking, India perhaps is not in a position to assist Nepal economically to a large extent. And that's why China could play its important role.
Last but not least, to finish this off, let's go back to Mr. Goldoni. Sir, do you think the United States will step up its Indo-Pacific interventionist games in order to undermine its chief adversary, China, under the Duba government?
I believe that Nepal is a very important geopolitical strategic in a strategic position, very, very important. For several reasons. One is regarding the borders, no? Because if we have seen recently, let's say in the last 1 year, where the most friction we have between India and China, all the friction was around the borders from the north of India, and then even to Bhutan, and definitely, because the border with Nepal and Tibet is so long, it will be strategic to try to influence and to control these countries. But I will add one more reason why is important. My analysis is the reason is important because the United States are trying to give something to India in order to bring the position to India more close to the United States, especially in confronting the two main problems, the geopolitical problem that now they have. It means Russia and China. And in the past, that India is not so much, as I can say, willing to take part, you know, from in this to let's say conflict, potential conflict, but Nepal could be a kind of candies, a kind of pawn that is you know, given to India in order to, you know, give something and try to you know, to bring India on the political side of the United States. I see this one in this point, you know. Yeah.
On that note, I would like to thank both our guests, Mr. Ahsun Oh from Kuala Lumpur and Mr. Fabrizio Goldoni from Hong Kong, for being on the program, and thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Nepal-based journalist Santosh Gimir says the results of country's general elections are yet to emerge, but it is likely that the dice is loaded in favor of the Nepali Congress-led alliance that is considered close to India. Anil Sigdale, a policy analyst and author, notes the emergence of a new equation in Nepali politics, especially one that carries an anti-American tone, which he says will continue to test American diplomacy in Nepal. Nepal-based academic Upendra Gautam points to foreign interference in Nepal after the general elections, citing reports saying that Indian diplomats are engaged in talks with politicians in the power corridors.
And that was our episode about Pakistan's growing strategic partnership with China and how it's giving jitters to hawks in Washington. And also, Nepal's general election being the good news for India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
Over 400,000 Yemenis have perished since the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition war broke out in 2014, making it the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, according to the UN. While U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end the war in Yemen, he is doing the opposite. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of RT wrote in this regard, 2 weeks into his term, U.S. President Joe Biden claimed that he would seek a negotiated peace in Yemen, thus shunning Saudi Arabia. Now he is performing a 180-degree pivot. With such arbitrary foreign policy positions, the U.S. regime is causing instability and weakening its own hand. On December 13th, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders decided to withdraw a war powers resolution on ending U.S. support for Saudi offensive efforts in the war in Yemen. Sanders was supposed to put the resolution to a vote, believing it would have passed. However, owing to pressure mounted against him from the White House, he decided to retreat. Instead, the progressive American senator claimed that he was informed that Biden administration would continue working with his office on ending the conflict. As revealed by The Intercept, which obtained the key talking points distributed by the White House against the resolution, the Biden administration communicated its position that such a resolution would be counterproductive and further exacerbate the crisis in Yemen. However, the Queen's Institute for Responsible Statecraft says that Sanders' decision to withdraw the resolution may embolden the many members of Washington foreign policy elite who would like to ensure that the president's capability to unilaterally wage war remains unchallenged by Congress' constitutional prerogative over matters of war and peace. The biggest problem here for the U.S. government is that the War Powers Resolution essentially aims to force Biden to implement most of the policies that he himself outlined in February of 2021. Despite Biden having announced that the U.S. was halting all relevant arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, which has been at war with Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement since 2015, this policy position has never been put into practice. During his 2020 campaign, Biden claimed that he would make long-time American ally Saudi Arabia a global pariah. Yet, when it began to